This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast. Got two guests lined up for you today. We begin in Washington, where the Wizards' disappointing year last year, 43 wins, didn't get out of the first round of the playoffs. They shake things up a little bit. They add Dwight Howard to the mix. They bring in Austin Rivers. They sign Jeff Green. I check in with Candace Buckner. It's a great job covering the Wizards for the Washington Post to talk all things going on in D.C. A little bit later on, Tony Jones does a great job of covering the Utah Jazz over at the Salt Lake Tribune. Tony and I talk about how the Jazz kind of decided to just keep the band together, bring everybody back, see if they can build on a surprising post-Gordon Hayward season. So we discuss all that and more with Tony Jones of the Salt Lake Tribune. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast, as promised, Candace Buckner covers the Wizards over at the Washington Post. Candace, thanks for joining me.
And thanks for having me.
Wizards are interesting. Let's start there. The 43 wins last year, going back, number 8 seed, first round exit, injuries clearly a factor in last season, but a pretty disappointing one in Washington. So the Wizards go out and make a few moves. Marcin Gortat is out. Dwight Howard, Austin Rivers, Jeff Green, they are in. So let's start with the big man, Dwight Howard. Washington, from what I know, was one of the few, maybe the only team seriously interested in Dwight Howard.
Right.
What's the thinking there? What do you think they expect from him? How does he fit into what they want to do?
Well, it seems like from Washington's perspective, he will be, and I think he will be, I think they envision him as an upgrade from Gortat. But it's just interesting to me that as the league goes one way, the Wizards are still zagging towards, we still need a traditional five. But still, he'll be more athletic than Gortat. He should be able to finish better than Gortat. And I think that's what John Wall needs. He just needs people to catch and finish when he is concentrating as a distributor. But what they're expecting from him, it is a one year audition. I would say for him, even though he has the option of coming back next year, talking to his side, it's very clear to me that he wants to continue his career. And I wrote the story about how he wants to play to 40, and you don't play to 40 by getting 8 one-year deals back to back to back to back to back. Eventually, you're going to have to get a big contract to stay somewhere. And I believe this is a season in which he really wants to showcase who the new 2.0 Dwight Howard is, and test himself on next year's market.
You wrote a great piece in the Post last month about just Dwight, and that the headline that stuck out was the "I want to play until I'm 40. It feels like Dwight, the start of every season, Charlotte, Atlanta, wherever he goes, It's the same stuff. He just talks about being a good teammate and fitting into a role, and then the season starts. And when I talk to people like Charlotte or Atlanta, it's not even like overt stuff that gets Dwight in trouble. It's like the passive aggressive. Instead of rolling to the basket, he shoots that broke jump shot of his. Instead of, when he doesn't get a post touch, he grumbles under his shirt about his teammates. Stuff that probably the average fan doesn't notice. But as like the coaches see it and the teammates see it and everybody sees it in the locker room. He never seems to have been able to get that stuff gets him into a lot of trouble. I just wonder if he's ever going to get that. If this is just kind of the same sort of Dwight trying to sell himself, and the end of the season, Washington's not going to be able to run away from him fast enough.
Right. So basically, when you sign in July, as a reporter, I'm going to take you at your word You know, I'm going to write down everything you say. Mm-hmm. But eventually, especially with someone like DeWitt, who has said this at the at his last stops, as you already mentioned, you want to see more, and you just want to take him at his word in July. But when October comes and it's training camp and it's preseason and you start evaluating his actual play on the court and see if it's aligning with his words, then we'll see really if DeWitt gets it. And I don't know his state of mind. I didn't pay attention to the Hornets last year, and I only paid attention to him in Atlanta when the Wizards played them. So I don't know how many times he actually slipped the screen and didn't help his point guard out, or how many times he may have pouted on the defensive end. I don't know. And those are things that I've also heard that DeWitt later in his career has done. So who knows really where his state of mind is. But again, in July, if you talk to his side and you listen to his words, he sounds motivated. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm sure Rick Bonnell can say, who covered the Charlotte Hornets last year, that he could say the exact same thing that I'm saying now. And so same for the Atlanta reporters. But, you know, I'll quote him accurately and I'll tell his story. But soon those words are going to have to become actions. And if they're not, this Wizards fan base, which is one of the most fatalist fan bases, I think, in the league, they're gonna run out of patience soon.
Do you think that he, from talking to him, do you think that he gets that at this stage of his career, especially with this team, he's a role player? I mean, the guards are, as Washington goes, so go, you know, the Wizards guards there. Then you have Otto Porter getting his touches. Do you think he gets that it's probably going to be, you know, 8-9 shots per night for him here on out?
And that's a great question. Again, at the press conference, everybody says all the right things that, you know, I'll defend, I'll rebound, and I'm just here to do what they want me to do here. But who really knows? This has been a man who he really has been a superstar for most of his career. And how easy is it for you to shift that mentality to, guys, I'm the fourth option. He's the fourth option on this team, especially if Otto Porter, you know, steps up and gets a little bit more aggressive, as he very well should. So does he get that? Tremendous question, Chris. I don't know. Time will tell.
He's got to be one of the most fascinating characters in the NBA at this point, because like the injury stuff is kind of out the door. I mean, he was 81 games last year and he gave you 16-12. Like, you know, that kind of, like, on paper, you'd think teams would be tripping over themselves to get that type of player. Now, maybe some of it is, as you kind of alluded to, other teams are kind of, you know, you're zigging one way with small ball type of lineups and floor spacers at the five, but you would think there'd be a number of teams trying to go after him, but you know, it was Washington. I'm not really sure there was a second choice there.
I guess there were some rumors that Golden, that he had some tests at Golden State. I don't know how true that is. But you know, if you had the choice between Golden State Warriors and Washington Wizards, then I don't think it is a choice. So I am curious, and you said interesting at the beginning of this podcast of how describing the Wizards. I think they are interesting. I think they will be one of the most interesting teams in the East, just because of the off court, the locker room, and seeing if this experiment actually works on the court. There's so many elements that can go wrong this season, Chris. They got six rotation guys, essentially in a 1-year deal. Mm. So how does that dynamic, how does chemistry work? How do all these new guys, mesh with John Wall's entering his ninth year. Next season, he has that Supermax extension kick in. This team is going to be handicapped financially for years to come, unless, you know, something major happens. And so this is, to me, this could be like a turning point type of season.
Mm-hmm. The other two guys I mentioned that the Wizards picked up, Austin Rivers in that trade with Gortat, and of course, Jeff Green, has been around the block a few times. Either one of them, do you see, I mean, as being significantly impactful, something Washington needs?
Well, I think, you just look at Austin Rivers, and especially they have this shortage with the backup too, with Jody Meeks missing the first 19 games of the season after a drug suspension, serving out the rest of his drug suspension. You think, okay, Austin can play the two. He can definitely spell Bradley Beal for some minutes and also play the one, so that's good. But I really like the Jeff Green pickup. I don't know how much of a vocal leader he is within the locker room, but the guy has been around. He last year, you know, he was a big reason why the as you were at that game, he's a big reason why the Cavs got past the Celtics in Game 7. And so him and I believe Yamahimi are the only ones in that locker room with finals experience. And I just believe that because he'll be a little bit more of a contributor, that his voice may resonate more in that locker room as that missing veteran leader that they haven't had over the last 2 years. And that's been a hole since Paul Pierce left Washington, last 2-3 years, maybe. So I really like that Jeff Green pickup, and he's one of the one-year guys. And I'm thinking he's supposed to, you know, replace what Mike Scott left as a void. But I really think that he can be maybe a calming influence in the locker room. But I also heard that he's a bit of a you know, a jokester too. So I wonder how that dynamic with, you know, Dwight will work out. But somebody needs to settle down that locker room. And I nominate Jeff Green.
when you say settle down, what do you mean by that?
There's this way. Okay, so they're young, but this is an old group, and I just feel like even though they've logged years, I just don't see like a calming voice or like to get dudes to speak to a guy and get them on board. So this last year, that whole team meeting thing that came out, that John Wall just randomly dropped in January, that they had this meeting 2 months ago, and some guys didn't take it right. Filling in the blanks after the season, trying to get a little bit more of that meeting. Meeting was pretty much a bunch of pointing fingers, and how is that productive? Maybe that works with some guys, but if you're pointing a finger and a guy sees you not playing defense or sees you shot hunting, and these are things that, you know, that even the voices of the locker room would say that guys were out there getting stats. Well, if those same guys think that you're the one that's out there getting stats or not defending, then that's a problem, and you can't point the finger. So I think somebody with a little gravitas needs to come in and kind of be the one to calm down the finger pointing and that energy doesn't seem like that energy last year didn't seem like it unified the locker room. So there needs to be somebody that can play both sides, for lack of a better term, and talk to a guy that maybe feels ostracized or picked on, but also relate to the leaders on the court, John and Brad, and help them be able to communicate effectively.
Does that guy, I mean, I want to get to John Wall, the player, but does that guy, the calming influence, shouldn't that be John Wall at this point? I mean, he's going to be 28 this week. You mentioned the number of years he's played. I mean, shouldn't he have a grab on that role at this point?
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, you are who you are. If your personality, John has been on the record of saying, you know, he didn't come in as a leader, and this is something that he's had to learn. Mm-hmm. But if your personality isn't, you know, the kind of kumbaya and slap guys on the back and say, oh, shucks, it's going to be okay, and you know, put an arm around a guy, if that's just not who you are, then it comes across as fraudulent, and no one's going to trust it anyway. So if this leadership style may be a little grating or aggressive, and you know, you talk to John Wall, he talks really fiery. He talks like his cadence is very up all the time. He uses his hands. And I think during game two of the playoffs, there was that shot that became a meme of him and Gortat discussing something. Mm-hmm. Bradley Beal feels like he's living the nightmare that was the 2017-2018 season next to them. But that's just, I really believe, like, that's just the way that John talks. He's always kind of fired up and animated. So I don't know if, you know, behind closed doors, that calms down. Who knows? But I think Paul Pierce did something for them that we haven't seen since. And whatever gravity that he brought to the situation and, you know, maturity and just calmness, it worked that season. They really do need that again.
That was an iconic NBA Twitter photo that one of the bench. Just, I mean, you couldn't turn on Twitter for months without seeing somebody allude to that picture.
It's like watching mom and dad fight, and you're like, yeah. Oh, would they stop? But yeah, he was having a nightmare of a game, so I think he was more into his sorrow because of that.
Yeah, nightmare of a game and nightmare of a season for Wall, who I mentioned is going to be 28 this week. And, you know, prior to last season, you know, relatively durable, 75-plus games each of the last 4 years. Missed half the season last year with that knee injury. You mentioned the contract. He's going to make $19 million this year, almost $38 million next season. Has battled knee problems, though, these last few years. I mean, do you think the Wizards are going to be maybe – are you going to treat him with kid gloves going into this season? Do you limit him? How do you protect John Wall, who's been through so much physically?
Right. You got to protect him sometimes, I think, from himself. Even when he came back after that knee injury, and he missed some games early on because of a shoulder injury, so it's kind of like a various shoulder deal. But when he came back, he was going headlong into the rim, attacking, crashing to the court, and – kind of playing full out. I don't know if the Wizards need that John Wall, 9 years in, 28 years old. And he doesn't have a lot of playoff mileage because they never made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. But still, 9 years is 9 years. And you're coming off having, no matter how small it was, surgery is surgery. You're coming off having surgery in less than this 12-month calendar. They do need to protect John a little bit more. Bradley played a gang of minutes, a career high minutes, played all 82 games. And maybe he can take that because he's still, 25, 26. He just had a birthday. But John Wall, as your franchise guy who is supposed to be here for the prime of his career, you do have to do a better job protecting him. And they always say, you know, it's not just game minutes, but it's load. And so they track how much they keep them on the court for practices. And sometimes, of course, as you know, stars don't practice. But I think his game probably needs to change a little bit. And if that doesn't change, because they still need a dynamic John Wall to go, they need to find a suitable backup so they can give him some rest throughout the game.
Yeah, you know, it's the next, I'm curious what the next evolution of John Wall is, because he's been so, like, speed has been his thing, you know, going to the rim, right, attacking, all that stuff. I mean, can he evolve into something more? I don't think he's ever going to be a dead-eye three-point shooter, but we have seen point guards, you know, evolve in different stages of their careers into different players. I wonder if, because, I mean, he's untradeable. I mean, he's literally untradeable because of the contract and the knee.
Well,
you don't think so? You disagree?
Well, Greg, wouldn't you think Blake Griffin was untradeable? I'm totally not advocating mm-hmm. to trade John Wall, but I have, after what happened with Blake last year, I'm thinking, even if you get these crazy supermax contracts, you're not untouchable. Mm. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I didn't think of Blake for a second there, but I mean, it would take what Detroit was, right? A desperate team with, like, no cap flexibility that had to do that. This was the only way they could potentially shake up the Etch-a-Sketch and make it happen. I mean, there's probably a finite number of teams that would even consider, unless he goes out next year and plays like an all NBA point guard again. Right. I mean, unless he looks right, like the young John Wall. But I mean, are you expecting scaled? I mean, we kind of touched on it, but scaled back minutes, more Satoransky at that spot. I mean, is this going to be a different look, do you think, for John Wall this year?
Yeah, I'm actually, a little interested about what will happen there, because I thought Thomas Satoransky, all things considered, did a good job filling in for John Wall after his surgery. He might have worn down a little bit near the end, but you know, he was a capable guy in place of John Wall, and I thought he would have been perfect as his backup. But you go to the playoffs, maybe being Ty Lawson, and essentially Thomas Satoransky is out of the rotation. So do they trust, or does Scott Brooks trust Thomas Satoransky enough to be a capable backup for John Wall? That's one of the many questions that I have going into next season, because if he really did trust in him, then why didn't he use him in the playoffs? Mm-hmm. So, and he's another one of those guys. He's on a 1 year. He's in the last year of his deal. So, I imagine when he is on a court, he wants to showcase what he can do. But does the team trust him enough to be that guy to give John Wall a break?
I feel like we say this going into every year, the last few seasons, about the significance of the year for that their backcourt with Wall and Beal.
Yeah.
Is this any different, do you think? I mean, we talked about John Wall being, tough to trade, Beal less so, of course. Do you look at this as being a significant season for those two?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Every season is one, but this one in particular, because John's coming off the surgery, and he's been promoting his summer separation on social media. And so obviously he's looking to do and to make some noise in year nine. And Brad, who had a career year, was a first-time All-Star. He made progress, but there are still many things that he can improve on. I think chief among them is how he performs in late-game situations. He had that breakout moment in Portland last year, scoring 51 points. And he shows that he can lead. He can be a facilitator when John was out. But there's other things that he can work on. He can be a facilitator, but he can also work on that. There were a lot of times where, I guess his decisions weren't always the sharpest, and turnovers ensued. But he's a young player who needs to take that next step and not just be an all-star. But I think now they can rightfully claim the best backcourt in the East, now that DeMar DeRozan is in the West. But It's really time to see the manifestation of all of the bluster that we have heard over the last few years, that teams are scared of us, no one wants to play the Wizards, they know what's up, blah blah blah, but actually let's see that work out on the court.
They do love to say stuff like that. It's almost become like comical. Like every year it's like, we're coming to get you, we're the boogeyman. Then it's like, how do you define
maybe
coming to get you?
They've learned their lesson though.
Yeah, how would you describe the relationship between Wall and Beal? Is it solid at this point? Any tension there?
I do think it's solid. I've been this will be the start of my third season on the beat, and my first year that summer Bradley Beal signed his extension. And both players did this interview with the local broadcast partner and said that, I think John Wall's quote was, sometimes we have a tendency to dislike each other on the court. And that was, rightfully ran with in NBA Twitter sphere. But when I saw them together that year, last year, their interactions within the locker room, when we're allowed to see them, those little tiny interactions after shoot around, and when you can really gauge who has relationships within the team, like those moments, I never saw like animosity or disconnect. And last year, I thought it was actually probably really good for Bradley to step up. Because he had to. John wasn't on the court, and I don't think that's a coincidence that suddenly he has his best year, and John's not on the court. But I think it'll be false equivalency to say that he's just a better player without John on the court. That's just not the case. They should be able to complement each other. Now they are an all-star backcourt, and if you look at some of the best teams who have multiple all-stars. You should see a little bit. I'm sorry. The Wizards should see a little bit of unity and cohesion between those two guys, and they should be able to feed off each other and work off each other. So I think their relationship is just fine. I wrote a big story about Brad Beal before the All-Star break, and one of the tidbits that he said that sometimes he goes to John's house and they have like a doggy play date. He brings his dogs and. John has his bevy of dogs, but John has never been to his house. I think they're probably at, if we could probably put it like in our sense, probably just really cool coworkers. Mm-hmm. Do I see John going to like his baby shower? Because recently Brad and his girlfriend just had a baby. No, but I do think they're cool enough and they can coexist long enough to be at each other's necks.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the few areas outside of the, you know, John Wall getting healthy and some of the stars doing some things, one of the areas they have the ability to get better internally is probably with a guy like Kelly Oubre. You know, what's he entering his fourth year in the league, right? Averaged 12 points, improved his 3-point shooting into the mid 30s, but I think he only shot like under 30% from three after February. And I saw 17% from three in the playoffs. I mean, he is extension eligible. Let me start there. Do you think the Wizards make any serious effort to extend him?
I don't think so. And just because of history, they didn't do it with Otto Porter and they didn't do it with Bradley Beal. They were able to max out both of those guys, but now with their cap situation, I really doubt they, and just with their history, I just really doubt they'll do that with Kelly.
Mm-hmm. What do you think they, you know, where is his room for improvement? Where can he, you know, help that team in different ways?
Well, yeah, his role is supposed to be, you know, defending essentially 3-4 positions, and defense is supposed to be his calling card. And when he veers away from that, that's when Scott Brooks wants to veer away from him. Problem is, you know, when you're young and you are entering a contract year, you want to showcase a little bit more. I do believe that he can work on his 3-point shot again. And as you said, he faded after the All-Star break. So work on that consistency of knocking down a jumper, because when he is on the court and they go small and he's playing the three and Otto may be the four, he'll have open shots in the corner. And I just don't remember a lot of times at the end of last year, after February, him being able to knock down those shots. I think he's done a great job in being able to, you know, lead a fast break or score in open court. And sometimes finding an open guy, there were times when his head was just only focused on the rim and mistakes followed because you're not looking up and finding guys on the court. But he's a better finisher. He was a better finisher and did a better job passing the ball. But consistent effort, maybe not effort, that's not the word, but consistent focus on defense is probably where the Wizards would like to see him improve. And just for his stock in the open market next year, consistency in knocking down those open threes.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me finish with the coach. You mentioned Scott Brooks and year three of a pretty big contract for him. Do you see any pressure on him this year? I mean, the Wizards historically are quite resistant to change in a lot of ways, both in the general manager and the head coach mm-hmm. positions. But is there any more pressure on him to succeed this year?
I agree with my colleague, our columnist Jerry Brewer, who after I think the Dwight signing, he said the emphasis is Scott Brooks to keep the locker room intact, because if the locker room if there are locker room problems and last year they clearly were. How about we stop putting it in the hands of the players and we focus on this highly paid coach? He's one of the most highest paid coaches in the league, and he has a bevy of talent. And it should be on him. The onus, I should say, should be on him. That was Jerry Brewer's thoughts on all of this. So maybe not pressure, but I would say we're going to be looking at him a little bit closer this year than maybe in the past years, because if we are saying there's a leadership void in the locker room, that should never be the case when you have a head coach who's been to the NBA Finals, who's coached superstars, three MVPs before they before they really took off. So maybe not pressure, but definitely looking at Scott a little bit closer and inspecting his work on the court and in that locker room closer this year.
I think you are going to have arguably the most interesting beat in the league. I think the Lakers might be the most interesting beat, but for the East Coast, I mean, that's that the potential for daily drama down there, Candace, I think is is relatively high.
Can't wait. Yay.
Candace, keep up the great work. Thanks for joining me here on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. Enjoy whatever you do, Chris.
I shall.
That's a bad sign off. I'm sorry. Thanks for having me, Chris.
We'll take both. We'll keep it all in there.
Okay.
All right. My thanks to Candace Buckner for joining me. And joining me now on the podcast is Tony Jones. It's a great job covering the Utah Jazz over at the Salt Lake Tribune. Tony, what's happening, man?
Nothing at all. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, man, because you've got a good team out there in Utah. I mean, by any metric, I mean, last season was a raging success in Utah. Lose Gordon Hayward, win 48 games, get back to the second round. And it seems like, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like the Jazz just decided that if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. They brought the band, you know, back together. Derek Favors got a new deal. Dante Exum returned. So it's pretty clear to me that Utah is just banking on that great internal development that they've had in recent years to get them to that next level. Is that a fair way to phrase it?
Yeah, I think it's a fair way to phrase it. I think, you know, one of the things with general manager Dennis Lindsay saw was tremendous growth from the group in the second half of the season after, you know, taking 2 or 3 months to for the group to kind of acclimate itself. And what he saw was, you know, he took the metrics from, you know, Rudy Gobert playing the second half of the season, and he said, hey, okay, so what if we brought this group back? We you know, you hopefully get Rudy Gobert back for, you know, 75 to 80 games. You get Dante Exum back after Dante practically missed the entire regular season last year, and bring this group back. And run this group back for an entire season. And, you know, I think that, you know, Lindsay's, you know, thought process was he wants to see what this group can do. You know, they're not sure, you know, that they're any closer to Houston and Golden State, but they want to find out exactly where they are. And I think, you know, playing so well in the second half of the season last year has kind of piqued Dennis Lindsay's interest in relation to keeping this group together for another year.
Yeah, a couple things about the offseason I found interesting. One was Favors coming back. I mean, you're much closer to it than I was, but I thought of any of the guys that were free agents that could be on the move, I thought he would be the one of them. The two-year deal, second year, not guaranteed, of course, but that was the one guy, Tony, I thought was gone, both because there could have been interest elsewhere, and I did wonder if the Jazz might embrace that small ball shooting at the four alongside Rudy Gobert. What did you think of Favors returning?
Well, I think that the Jazz think that they have the best of both worlds in terms of being able to be unique, in terms of having two rim protectors and being able to keep a rim protector on the floor for 48 minutes, which is something that not a lot of NBA teams can do. But the second thing is there's a lot of clarity on both sides with Derek Favors and the Utah Jazz in terms of what Derek's role is going to be. You know, he's going to start every game. He's going to come out around the 8-minute mark of the first quarter. And then essentially from that 8-minute mark of the first quarter on, or the 6-minute mark, he essentially switches off of Rudy Gobert for the rest of the half. So in totality, he'll play 25 to 28 minutes a game. You know, he won't close a lot of games, because they'll close with Jay Crowder or Tabo Sefolosha or even Royce O'Neal or Joe Ingles at the four. So they get the sense of being big, but they can also go. They also have the ability to go small for long stretches as well. And I think that it worked well for them, especially in the second half of last season. And Derek, he re-signed with the Jazz, you know, with his eyes open in terms of what his role is going to be. So I think. I think that both sides are looking at this as a win-win.
Yeah, and he could even be a really interesting trade ship come February too, right? Because, you know, there are going to be a lot of teams looking to slash payroll going into next summer. The Jazz, you know, presumably may not want to be one of them. If they think they can, you know, make a run in the playoffs and a team's looking to move an asset in exchange for an expiring-ish contract, I think it seems like he could be a pretty good asset for them in that regard too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's somebody who, you know, if he goes to any other, you know, most other teams in the league, then he becomes a starting center in this league. And he's still 26, 27 years old. He's a guy who's proven to be a really, really, really good locker room presence. And he's a guy that I think, you know, is mature enough to understand the business of the NBA. And I think that that goes a long way towards what his value to a team is. You know, I think that, you know, what I've been told from internally is that the Jazz really want this to work. They're not sure that it's going to work past another year, which is why the second year is non-guaranteed. But I think that Derek Favors looked at the market, realized that the market was going to be really saturated, and decided to come back and have a good year, or hopefully to have as good a year as possible, and test the free agency market next year, where there should be a little bit more money freed up around the league.
So, you know, visiting Utah late last season, I did get the sense from talking to people there that they were reasonably confident they could get a deal done with Dante Exum to bring him back long-term. Even with two of the last 3 years, you know, basically decimated by pretty catastrophic injuries, the Jazz clearly still believe in him as a part of their future core. The three-year deal at $33 million, that did surprise me a little bit, Tony, the money that they invested in Dante Exum at $11 million per year. Now, I get it. The salary cap is what it is, and that's basically mid-level money right now. But what did you make of that deal for Exum? And what do you think they have kind of in store for him or hope to get from him next season?
Well, I think that this year is the year where I think that he's going to set his career path. I think that he's going to have to prove, you know, Dante Exum wants to be a starting point guard in this league, and he believes that he's a starting point guard in this league. And I think that this is the year that he's going to have to play well enough to prove that he can be. If he never gets better, I think that he's on a path where he's a valuable rotation player because he's really good defensively. And obviously he has size and athleticism at that point guard spot. But, you know, Dante wants more for himself. And I think that he's a guy that's got to prove that he's capable of more. And I think the Jazz believe that he's capable of more. They believe that he's capable of shooting the ball better. They think that, you know, if he can stay healthy, that his game still has, you know, significant growth left. You got to realize that he's going into his fifth year, but he's only 23 years old. He just turned 23. So I think that, you know, when the Jazz look at the sum of the parts when it comes to Dante Exum, they believe that there's still growth left in his game, and they wanted to lock that up, and they wanted to show some confidence in him, show some faith in him, which is why they gave him the years, and they gave him the money as well.
Do you think he has those point guard skills? I go back and forth on that. Now, I've liked Dante Exum a lot since he, you know, came into the NBA, but I haven't seen enough to know if a guy with his size can be, you know, a full-time point guard in this league. What do you think?
Well, I think that he's good in the pick and roll. He's good at making that initial read. He's a good passer out of the pick and roll. That's very point guard-like. I think that he's a guy that can get to the basket rather easily against a lot of point guards. But I think that he's got to prove that he can run a team. He hasn't proven that he can do that yet. And I think that, you know, the hallmark of point guards in today's league are guys that are able to break you down off the dribble, guys that have, you know, really nice handles and crafty handles. And he's got to prove that he can do that as well. You know, so there are two pretty big, you know, areas that he's going to have to show improvement and prove that he can do. He's got to prove that he can run a team. And that's something that I can't stress enough. And if he can do those two things, you know, he's got a chance to be a starting point guard in this league, but he clearly believes that he's a point guard. You know, I think Ricky Rubio, Dante would do well to really learn from what Ricky can do, because one of the things that Ricky can really well is run a team and get guys in the right spots and call the right plays and recognize mismatches on the floor with his teammates. And Dante has to be able to do that. I think that he can, but he's got to develop into that guy this year and going forward.
What do you think of the Jazz? I mean, Ricky Rubio, you think of him and you're like, oh, he's got to be 30, right? He's 27 years old. Like, it's unbelievable that this guy, he's just been on the radar, whether it's playing overseas as a teenager to, you know, to when he was with Minnesota. It feels like he's been around forever, but he is still a pretty young guy and does fit in with what the Jazz are looking to do in terms of developing a young team. Is his future with the Jazz, you think, tied to the development of Dante Exum, or do they think that these two guys could coexist together for a long time?
Well, I think that there's a faction that believes that those guys can coexist, especially if Dante, you know, becomes a 36, 37, 38% three-point shooter. You know, they really love the way, you know, Dante's size complements Ricky at the one. And I'll tell you, you know, the Jazz couldn't have been happier with Rubio's development. You know, the first 2 months of the season, the first 3 months of the season were really, really rough for him. You know, he was turning the ball over really uncharacteristically because he never really turns the ball over. He wasn't confident in shooting the ball, but they empowered him. Like, they said, hey, every time that you're open, we want you to shoot the basketball to the point where we're going to take you out of the game if you don't shoot the basketball. And, you know, it really paid off well in the second half of the season. And in the playoffs, there were times that Ricky Rubio was the best player on the floor in that Oklahoma City series in the first round, especially in the first half of game three. And there were times where Rubio was playing like an elite point guard, especially in the second half of the regular season. You know, he started to shoot the ball better. He figured out what his role was within the Jazz offense. He developed a rapport with Rudy Gobert. And I think that, you know, you started to see in the second half of that regular season, Ricky Rubio do some things that we've never seen Ricky Rubio be able to do. So, you know, if he can roll that in and translate that into this season, I think the Jazz are going to be really difficult to beat because, you know, I don't think that the Jazz realized that Rubio could thrive in that offense even to the point where he did last year. And I think that if that all of that translates, I think that the Jazz have a really nice backcourt with Rubio and Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah, Rubio, you know, never going to be kind of that dead-eye three-point shooter, but 35% from three last year was a career high for him. That's, if he can, you know, do that or a little bit more, he's pretty dangerous as a point guard.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the crux of his development. And I think that the turning point for him came late January last year when he hit that game-winning three-pointer against Toronto Raptors on the road. And in a lot of ways, that win facilitated with the Jazz run through the second half of the season. But it also jump-started Rubio, and I think that it gave him a lot of confidence. And he was just really tremendous in the second half of the season.
Yeah. Now the face of the Jazz now is, you know, Rudy Gobert might be the best player or however you want to put it, but Donovan Mitchell, clearly the face of that team. Tremendous rookie season, you know, on the court and even off it as well, with how he conducted himself and sort of the spark he gave that organization. Now that we've seen what he is, Tony, as a player that he became last season coming out of Louisville, the next step for him, what do you think that is? What do the Jazz want to turn him into in year two, year three down the line?
Well, the next step for him immediately is for him to become more efficient, right? You know, you want him to be that guy. So let's take Kevin Durant, for example. You can go an entire game and kind of not realize that Kevin Durant, you know, is playing because he can kind of be anonymous a little bit. And then you can look at the stat sheet. And you can say, oh, my goodness, well, Kevin Durant just shot, you know, 14 for 19. You know, he scored 35 points and had 8 rebounds and had 7 assists. How did this happen? And, you know, and obviously, you know, Donovan Mitchell's not going to get to that level this season, but you want him trending towards that level where, you know, he just gets easy points. And, you know, he's a guy who can score with ease, and he can score within the flow of the offense. You know, Donovan Mitchell is a spectacular scorer right now. And the Jazz want to turn him into, you know, a quiet, lethal, efficient scorer. And they want him to be, you know, a guy that can get up into that 40, 45 to 50% range in terms of field goals. They want him to be that guy that that can just go out and get buckets, you know, in a variety of ways. They want him to, you know, get to the free throw line a little bit more, which should come this season. They want, you know, they want him to be a little bit more efficient from beyond the arc, and they obviously want him to do some of the other things, you know, in terms of playmaking and figuring out ways to rebound the ball more. You know, it's just, you know, a natural growth from a guy's rookie season. You know, when you look at Donovan, and obviously you didn't think that he was a rookie towards the second half of the season. You know, but, you know, he's a guy that I think that can, you know, maybe average 25 points per game this season. He's a guy that can, you know, be an elite scorer in this league. And I think that the Jazz want to set him on that path, you know, much in the way that they want Dante Exum to set himself on the path to trying to be a starting point guard in this league.
You know, Donovan at this point doesn't have to be a leader necessarily on that team, because they've got Gobert there, Favors, Joe Ingles, you know, a really strong locker room with veteran players. But as his career progresses, did you get any sense that he has those qualities, those leadership qualities that you know, will eventually make him kind of the face of that locker room?
You know, it's funny because I thought that, you know, a lot of that stuff came out last year. And he was a guy that wasn't afraid to speak his mind within the locker room and on the floor last year. And I think that he's a guy that I think, you know, it's certainly by year three, but maybe even by year two, is a guy that's going to be able to take over the locker room in terms of a leadership perspective. And, you know, the good thing about the locker room that he's in right now is that the older guys, they're not afraid to step back and let him lead. And, you know, they know what they have in Donovan Mitchell. I think that Donovan has earned and commanded respect from the way, you know, as you said, that he conducted himself on and off the floor. And it's a close and a really tight-knit locker room. And I think that there's a lot of leaders in that locker room, from you know, Donovan to Joe Ingles to Rudy Gobert in his own way, to even, you know, veterans in Epe Udo and Thabo Sefolosha. So, you know, I think that Donovan's a naturally an alpha type of a player, and I think that he's that you're going to see that come out a little bit more and more, especially as his career progresses with the Jazz. But I wouldn't be shocked to see him take a real leap in that department this season.
You know, if there's one critique about this offseason for Utah, is that I thought they might try to find more shooting on free agency somewhere. Didn't really do that. How big an issue, if at all, do you think that's going to be for this team next year? The lack maybe
of
knockdown.
That remains to be seen. And I think one of the things that they're banking on is internal development. Mm-hmm. You know, they're banking on, you know, Dante Exum becoming a better shooter. They're banking on Royce O'Neal becoming a better shooter. You know, they're banking on Donovan Mitchell becoming a better shooter. You know, that was one of the reasons why they decided to run this back, was because they have, you know, a lot of young guys in that rotation that they really looked at and said, okay, all of these guys can get better with a lot of work over the summer. So, you know, if all of that stuff comes to fruition, you know, it's not as much of a problem. But if it doesn't come to fruition, then, you know, you're looking at, you know, Joe Ingles as potentially your only true knockdown shooter, other than maybe a Grayson Allen, who you don't know how much time he's going to even get in this rotation. So a lot of that depends on Dante Exum and Donovan Mitchell, and Royce O'Neal and even Jay Crowder with an entire year of acclimation in the system. But if all of that stuff can happen and all of those guys can get better, it's not as much of a problem as it appears right now on paper.
Now, if you're banking on internal development, I don't know how many teams are better at it at this point than what Utah is. I mean, they just take even like a veteran guy. I mean, I saw Jay Crowder in Cleveland. I thought he was done. I covered him extensively in Boston. He was great. He goes to Cleveland. I thought he was toast, and he gets reinvigorated in that Jazz system. I mean, they just, I don't know what it is, Tony, but they from Quinn Snyder on down, their player development program is just excellent.
Yeah, it's one of the best that I've seen. And, you know, obviously the Jazz are the only team, the only NBA team that I've covered in my career But you do look at that internal development, and you do look at the player development and how guys are getting better. I mean, I can look at the end of the roster. You know, George Yang, when he came to the Jazz, I mean, he did not look like an NBA player. And then you watch him in summer league, and not only does he look like an NBA player, he looks like an NBA rotation player. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the internal development that the Jazz have been able to use so well. I mean, it's very San Antonio Spurs-like, you know, which makes sense because, you know, a lot of the roots of the Jazz, you know, come from the Spurs in terms of Dennis Lindsay and Quinn Snyder. You know, but you look at Joe Ingles, I don't think anybody could have predicted that he'd become, you know, one of the top 10 or 12 or 15 small forwards in the NBA when he first came to the Jazz. You know, so I think you look at, you know, somebody like a Jay Crowder, you know, who, you know, went to Cleveland and basically dealt with a lot of adverse circumstances in terms of his fit in that locker room and on the floor. And then he looks like a completely different player with the Jazz. So, you know, I think that they have, you know, a real knack of developing guys and even veteran guys. And I think that, you know, that's another one of the reasons why the Jazz decided to bring back their entire roster this year.
All right, let me finish with a little bit more on that player development angle. Grayson Allen was the top draft pick in this year's draft for Utah. The Jazz have kind of earned the right to not be second-guessed necessarily because of who they've drafted and how they've developed in recent years. But I thought that was a pretty interesting pick there. I mean, Grayson's tremendously athletic, but you know, he certainly had some problems at Duke, the tripping stuff, maturity issues, things like that. What did you see from Grayson Allen during summer league, and from what you've been able to glean? I mean, do you expect him to have a role with this team this year? I mean, what do they hope to get from him in his first season?
Well, that's the funny part. You know, barring injury, I mean, who's he going to play over?
Yeah.
You know, I just don't see him, you know, being, you know, an integral part of the rotation in the first year because the Jazz are, you know, so deep this season. I mean, it's going to be hard for him to get on the floor. And, you know, that being said, I thought that he played really well in summer league. Like, I think, you know, the most surprising thing that I saw from Grayson Allen is that I think that he can actually be an NBA point guard. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think that, you know, he's got a really nice handle. He's got a really nice feel for running pick and roll, and he's a surprisingly good passer. You know, I think that he's a guy that you know, can develop into a really nice role player, maybe even a starter. He can shoot. As you said, he's really athletic. He can pass the basketball. He's a guy that has an aptitude defensively. And, you know, he's not scared. He's going to go at his opponent, and he's going to play hard. You know, that being said, I mean, it's funny because a lot of Jazz fans have asked me, well, how much do you see Grayson Allen playing? But the truth is I don't see him playing a lot because there's just so many guys that are ahead of him that I think that if this Jazz team stays healthy, that I think that it's going to be hard for him to carve out a role in his rookie season.
Was he just to them then just best guy on the board, or do they see him as something else down the line?
Well, they really liked him. They really liked him in the combine, and they really liked him when they brought him in for an individual workout. He worked out with some real heavy hitters. He had Jalen Brunson in his workout. He had Kyrie Thomas in his workout, I believe. So he had, you know, a lot of good guys in his workout, and he was the best player in that workout. And I got that from, you know, executives, and I got that from a couple of players that are on the team who are at the workout. So, you know, he's a guy that really impressed the Jazz in the pre-draft process to the point where I wasn't surprised at all when I heard his name on draft night. So, you know, I think that the Jazz really like him and they want to develop him, you know, down the road. And I think that there could be a role for him if the Jazz suffer, you know, a couple of injuries. And, you know, knowing the Jazz and their history over the last years, they have not been able to stay healthy. So, you know, he's a guy that I think that the Jazz really liked, and I think that the Jazz really honed in on with their pick in the draft, and I think that they're happy with the fact that he's on the roster.
Certainly will be a different feeling when training camp rolls around this time, huh? I mean, last year, what was it, all Gordon Hayward all the time. Now it's like, how far can you guys go? I mean, it's incredible what a difference a year makes.
Yeah, you know, last year at this time, I mean, you know, when you know, we convened, you know, for media day and training camp, I mean, I think that the first, you know, 4 days of training camp, it was, okay, how are you guys going to deal without Gordon Hayward? How are you guys going to deal without Gordon Hayward? To the point where, you know, we were literally told not to stop asking about Gordon Hayward. And it's funny because, you know, I don't think anybody could have foreseen, you know, just how last year was going to play out. You know, I picked the Jazz to go to the playoffs to get, you know, one of the last two seeds. I thought that they had a chance to win 45 games because I thought that their defense was that good. But, you know, I don't think anybody could have foreseen, you know, them, you know, being 19 or 28, you know, at one point, and then basically, you know, winning 30 of their last 35 games. To get into the playoffs and to get into the playoffs as a five seed. So, you know, Donovan Mitchell, you know, in a lot of ways, he saved the franchise with his play, and he saved the franchise in terms of, you know, the value, not the value of the franchise, but the validity of, you know, the Jazz as a playoff team year in and year out, and I think that. They want to try to build on that and try to get to a point where they're championship level. And I think that they want to take this season to figure out exactly where their level is and what they have to do to get to that championship level next year in free agency.
Should be interesting. Tony, enjoy your last few weeks of freedom before training camp opens up. Always appreciate your time. Thanks for joining me, man.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I really, really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Candace Buckner and Tony Jones for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.